Welcome to the New Books Network.
Welcome to the New Books Network. I'm Stephen Pimper, host of the Public Policy Channel, and I am pleased today to welcome David E. Gilbert, who is the author of Countering Dispossession, Reclaiming Land, a Social Movement Ethnography, new out from the University of California Press. David, welcome. Thank you for joining us today.
Thanks so much.
So before we talk about the book itself, I wonder if you might tell people a little bit about who you are and what you do and what brought you to this particular project.
I'm an environmental anthropologist, and I'm active in the global movement to help displaced people reclaim land taken by governments and corporations. So I came to Casa Verde through my academic work and my interest in the emerging land back movement, an indigenous-led coalition that brings together now thousands of groups across the world. And I first came to learn about the place I decided to write this book about, that I call Casa Verde in Sumatra, through an invitation from a longtime friend and colleague activist with Friends of the Earth Indonesia. And he knew that I was interested in learning more about maybe something a little bit more hopeful than what we had been working on before, which was the problem of the expansion of industrial agribusiness across the world and the crises of social equality, autonomy, and also the ecological problems that industrial agriculture is often associated with, like massive deforestation, ecological damage, biodiversity extinction, and so forth. And, you know, my friend, he said, David, you know, why don't you go check out this place, Casa Verde in Sumatra? You might be really surprised at what's going on there. And so I a few days later, you know, I was in Indonesia, and a few days later, I decided to go there and see what was going on. And, yeah, you know, I was really, really surprised what was happening there for reasons I'm sure we'll get into. And, you know, the thing that stuck with me was that this is a hopeful story. And at that time, I really needed a hopeful story. I'd been working for years, first as an activist and then academic on these problems of industrial agriculture that I just mentioned. And here was a place that seemed to have overcome them, go beyond them, offered, you know, maybe solution is a bit too simple a way to think about it, but offered a real alternative to the problems of industrial agriculture. So that's what brought me to eventually spending over a year in the region known as Casa Verde. It's kind of like a town, or, you know, in Indonesia, they call themselves villages, but, you know, something like 30,000 people live there on the side of a beautiful mountain in the Bukit Barisan mountain range. And I just, you know, did some deep hanging out, as anthropologists like to call it, getting to know people. Yeah, actually, a term promoted and kind of made popular by none other than Clifford Geertz, you know, one of the leading anthropologists of the previous generation and also a specialist in Indonesia. So, yeah, I got to know people there and see, got to learn what they were up to, and really got to dive in deep to the history of Casa Verde and how they overcame this industrial agribusiness or this plantation. So I decided to kind of reorient my work around Casa Verde in a kind of a quintessential case study. And, you know, I go in deep in one place, but I try to keep those connections to geopolitics, to different scales of environmental change, of commodity circuits around the world, in what I think is kind of a, you know, a modern day case study method in anthropology.
Terrific. So I want to get to that hopeful story, but in order to situate it, why don't we maybe talk about a little bit of that darker history? I don't know how far back you want to go. You want to give us maybe sort of back of the envelope overview of sort of the Dutch colonial era, and then move us forward in time, maybe through a little bit of Suharto, and then sort of pick up where it seems to be sort of this reclamation from the dispossession seems to really kick into high gear.
Absolutely. Yeah, that's exactly right. You know, I imagine, as many of your listeners will know, Indonesia has a very long and troubled history with plantations. You know, it really gathered steam during the long Dutch occupation of the archipelago, which was, you know, over 300-year period. So there were many different kind of forms and strategies and techniques that colonizers used to dispossess indigenous Indonesians of many kinds. Of course, Indonesia is a place where there's more than 3,000 different languages and ethnicities, indigenous groups, but many people in Sumatra especially were dispossessed for plantations. You know, the first big ones were for tobacco. Also, of course, different spices, cloves, less so in Sumatra, more in the eastern islands, but the history of the Spice Islands and in a way a history in itself of global planetary colonization. And then after tobacco came rubber, and about the same time as rubber came palm oil. And these were all massive, massive areas, long single row plantings of a single monoculture commodity crop. This is kind of bringing the factory into the fields. This was a model that was by and large developed in Sumatra alongside in the Caribbean in different ways, but around the same time period. And things really started to ramp up and accelerate right around the turn of the 20th century. So, you know, in 1900 in Sumatra, there were hardly any of these large scale, what we could call industrial scale plantations for tobacco, rubber, or palm oil. But by 1920, you know, two decades into the 20th century, they were covering massive, massive areas of land, you know, kind of on the equivalent for our US listeners, you know, kind of on the equivalent size maybe of Northern California. So we saw this just radical transformation of the landscape, of lifeways, of forms of labor, right? And relations between the overseer and the coolie, as they were called. And we saw a massive movement of people to work at these plantations. First, the dispossession and expulsion of indigenous people, and then the bringing in of labor force from Java, also Sri Lanka, India, to a lesser extent, Greater Asia, China. So we have kind of one of the formative moments of global capitalism, if you could call it such a thing, occurring right around there, 1900, 1920. Then, you know, jump forward a long, long, very interesting storied history of independence and World War II with the invasion of the Japanese into Sumatra, and then another independence movement for Indonesia's to create the archipelago, the nation as it exists today. And then you had the rise of the New Order, you know, one of the most authoritarian and violent regimes of the 20th century, forming right around 1967, 68, 69. Along with a pogrom, you know, a massive, massive genocide of leftists, of progressives, of unions, of artists, of, you know, queer people, all types of people, but predominantly really the dismantling and massacre of people associated with communism or labeled there so much. And that same exact moment is when dispossession returned in full force to Cassiavera. That was the moment under the New Order regime that people lost their land. They had lost it originally under the Dutch in 1906 for a timber and cattle operation, but they had gained it back just a few decades after that. But with the New Order came kind of, I think, an even more severe, even more restrictive type of dispossession, really at the point of a gun, that brought this plantation under the ownership of a military police lieutenant general to the land and kind of reoriented people's lifestyles from quite free smallholder small-scale entrepreneurship, civil service, you know, working as teachers, you know, this kind of quite a diverse kind of milieu. So many people ended up working at the plantation as what they called coolies. Again, they kind of continued that word. And a fair amount of exploitation, violence and threats of violence, and difficult laboring conditions. And, you know, this was land that at the time was recognized as kind of belonging to this greater imagined community as indigenous or collective land. And there was really no doubt about that fact that there had been a community there for many, many, many generations, maybe not time immemorial, as people there like to say, but for a very long time, as Minangkabau people, predominantly indigenous Minangkabau people. And it was that moment in 1968 that they lost the land and unfolded almost, 30 years of plantation dispossession, you could call it there. And that's what's kind of set the scene for this remarkable reclamation that would unfold.
Perfect. So pick up the story there. So how do we turn this around? This sounds awful. And it sounds like these folks are overpowered and overwhelmed and have little tools available. Talk a little bit about how it starts. Maybe tell us a little bit about the formation of the community organization and the letter writing campaign, which I found absolutely fascinating. The initial efforts to work for people disadvantaged by the legal system to actually use the legal system to their advantage.
That's right. You know, we had a place where, you know, violent overseers and deforestation were predominant in this plantation. That was combination of a cattle ranch and a tobacco and ginger plantation where people were laboring as ranch hands and planters and pickers and pesticide sprayers, kind of carrying these plastic backpacks spraying pesticides. And eventually, Casa Vera's reclaiming movement was able to bring all of these problems to an end. And like where once this military general, police general I mentioned, was really the main beneficiary of this land. Eventually, over 200 families have come to use it as like a basis of their economy and their social reproduction and their well-being. And, you know, the great question for me was, how did this happen? Because, you know, if anything, it's not very common, these type of stories. Yep. And so I think, you know, I wanted to study it not because, you know, it's a really big trajectory of change that's happening out there in the countryside, but because of how unique it is and exemplary, and maybe there were some things to be learned. And, you know, it started as a very kind of quiet underground movement. Late kind of mid-90s, you know, this was almost now the end of the New Order, and the New Order's power kind of started to break apart a bit. Things started to open up. Like for the first time, newspapers were reporting on some of the ills of these plantations that had really taken off in the 70s, 80s, 90s. I mean, it was you know, more than a linear trajectory of expansion. It was, you know, exponential almost. And there started to emerge kind of a national reclaiming movement that was connected, but it was connected pretty deep underground still. People were really afraid to come out and talk about this. But, you know, there, people in Casa Vera told me that they had begun to hear about certain high profile cases of people taking land back. A few in Java, a few in Sumatra, especially. And so in Casa Vera, they told me, you know, they began just by talking to each other, which I thought was so simple, but also so profound. You know, at that time, there was a peasant union, as they called themselves, a peasant union that was operating underground. They had an important member in Casa Vera who started getting people together and kind of just having quiet conversations in his backyard in a rice paddy where no one could really hear anything. There's like bubbling brook and you're kind of out on their own. And, you know, that went on for some time, you know, as far as I understand, a period of some years, just these quiet conversations, you know, that's how it had to begin. But once people felt like they had a bit of an organization, a bit of organizing had happened, you know, they felt brave enough to kind of go up to the plantation land above their homes and kind of find these edges and just kind of start in places that weren't really being used. And just kind of starting to tend the earth a little bit, like maybe they'd plant some chili, or maybe they would collect some grass to feed a cow, or, you know, just these really light kind of sensitive uses to see if there'd be any response. And they didn't find any yet. And, you know, to this day, after years of research, deep archival research, and, you know, many hundreds of hours of interviews, it's still not quite clear to me if how active the company was at this point. The reclaiming movement claims that the company was basically bankrupt and wasn't doing much. The company, however, claimed that they were, you know, fully operational and profitable. And, you know, this was, they were using the plantation in a very productive way. And so there's a bit of a question mark about what was going on with the company at that time. But eventually, after the peasant union had some conversations with local state leadership, kind of like an equivalent of our, you know, we could call it kind of like a county supervisor or, you know, a mayor who said, you know, I support this reclaiming. You know, I don't think the plantation has been good for us, and this is our land. You know, after they got that kind of unofficial, just again, kind of rice paddy endorsement, you know, sitting in the back quietly, after they felt like they had some local leadership on their side, they blockaded the road leading to the plantation. And this was like a complete reversal of this very kind of quiet underground organizing. This was like very bold and brash. Basically at the same time, they destroyed the main office of the plantation company right in the middle of the plantation. A bunch of really a mixed group, as far as I understand, men, women, young people, old people, they went up together and destroyed the company offices after they made sure no one was in it. They also destroyed a workers' barracks.
And so this sorry, was, why do you think they were not met with violence?
This was, you know, a great risk. And I remember one woman who was there that day who participated in this form of direct action told me, you know, we were, what she said, neck got, we were reckless. You could translate that word to, although that word in Indonesian is kind of, it brings a connotation of not being afraid of death. So, you know, they understood what they were doing was, you know, very risky, and that they could be punished, you know, with death possibly. And, you know, why they weren't met with violence at that point, you know, there was a showdown. The company was able to bring some company security as well as some military, you know, in Indonesia, the military also operate within the country. So it's different than, you know, many other countries in the north, with some military. And there was a showdown where the unarmed reclaiming movement members, you know, many of them were carrying, you know, machetes and long sticks as a kind of show of force. But, you know, they faced down the military carrying weapons. And that day, the military decided to keep their weapons on their shoulder. And, you know, there's, I think, a number of reasons for that. I think that this was at the end of the New Order, where there was a great exhaustion with violence. You know, there was just spasms of violence racked the country in the early New Order. And there was a big push from leadership all the way down to the populace to do things differently. And this, what they called at the time, this dual function of the military to both protect the Indonesia's sovereignty, like it protect its borders, but also rule its people, was kind of coming to an end. You know, another really important reason was actually Kasiavera's reclaiming movement was able to bring a military officer to their side before the movement did this direct action. They actually kind of recruited someone from Indonesia's most kind of notorious intelligence military police agency, an agency that was responsible for basically for the detainment, torture, and disappearance of anyone they threatened, kind of an internal threat or internal terrorist to the country, they were able to convince the officer operating in the area of the validity of their claims to the land. And it seemed like, I actually have the letter that this officer wrote in the late 90s endorsing the Casio Vera reclamation. It seemed like the main reason they were able to convince this officer was the fact that he was from Casio Vera and he himself was a Minangkabau person. So we see here this great contingency of these type of struggles and the importance of finding allies in places really you might not expect to look. And that leads to the letter writing campaign that you mentioned. And this was one of the most remarkable parts of my fieldwork. You know, a bit into my fieldwork, I was actually given an archive of letters written from what's called a customary council that was operating in Casio Vera, also from the peasant union, and also from many state agencies that the peasant union and the customary council were writing to kind of promote this reclaiming movement. And I had spent at that point months looking for similar letters in all the normal places. The government archive had no mention of these things. A supporter of the movement, a long time, I wouldn't quite call him a movement member, but he was kind of a sympathetic, well-educated Casio Vera resident, a lawyer who's working in the public service. He had actually been kind of creating his own archive over many decades. It was quite remarkable. I was able to follow this letter campaign word for word across like over almost two decades. It started very humbly. It started from this customary council with requests to the local ministries for just some information about the plantation, like where are the borders, who owns it, where would they find more information about how the plantation operates. And these were some kind of like really non-controversial ways to make the government know that this local leadership was interested in supporting this claim. But not surprisingly, they didn't really receive any answer at all to start. And so they started escalating this campaign. Yeah. They started writing governors. They started writing the offices in Jakarta in the capital, some I think over 1,000 miles away. They started writing increasingly more bold statements about why they thought they should be entitled to have this land returned to them. And as they developed their expertise, they started making connections with legal representatives. Indonesia has an amazing tradition of legal aid organizations, really, really sophisticated, smart lawyers that are representing people usually for free. They're kind of like a foundation model. They were able to link up with one of the leading legal aid organizations in Indonesia. And you can see over time in the letters, the techniques that they're using of the law are really deepening and expanding, and they're coming up with new arguments, innovative arguments for why they should get the land back. And eventually the government starts responding. And although, the letter writing campaign never seemed to result in any formal letter from the government saying, yes, you can have the land back, I think it was very formative in ensuring that they were treated, with a certain level of respect and tolerance and not evicted from the land immediately. And this letter writing campaign kind of came to a head during a kind of second blockade where the Indonesian land agency sent a delegation to kind of look and see what was going on with this land, because the company started also writing to the Indonesian government saying, you have to help us out and get these people off of here. It's causing great economic damage to our company. And there you see, you know, this government agency validating the fact that the land is being used by the reclaimers. It's being used productively for their unique kind of forms of agriculture. And they refuse to kind of endorse the reclaimers movement, but they also kind of refuse to act and dispossess them. And that was like a great kind of de facto success for the reclaiming movement.
So as we work our way toward concluding, what does the land look like today?
Wow, today, you know, when you look out from the community of Casa Vera, you kind of look up onto the shoulder of the volcano about halfway up. And, you know, the first thing you see is a gate that used to read, "Welcome to the Dona Plantation." And now it says, "Welcome to the collective land," or Tana Ulaya, as they call it. And, you know, that road that was built during the Dutch era, the start of the plantation, it's still there, a cobblestone road. And there, instead of these open fields of exposed soil and long plantation crops, you see these remarkable closed canopy plots that to an observer like me, who's not, you know, doesn't have a ton of experience living in places like it, that it looks like a tropical rainforest, tropical cloud forest. And it is, but it's entirely planted, and it's entirely planted with really economically valuable crops. Things like avocado, cinnamon. You know, the cinnamon from that region is renowned. It's called Kurinchi cinnamon, and it's traded all over the world. And it's collected from the bark of these cinnamon trees that are planted there. Coffee isn't super common because for the people there, it brings back this history of forced cultivation of coffee of the Dutch. So instead of coffee, people are doing a lot more chocolate. And kind of these forests are organized in layers. So like the bottom layer is often valuable medicinal shrubs and plants. And then you have these smaller trees that can grow underneath the canopy like chocolate. And then you have these larger fruit trees like durian, avocados kind of in between those. And then you have these timber crops that are planted that are the largest kind of canopy emergent trees. Things like red cedar and teak that are incredibly valuable. And, you know, all of this was planted by the people there in a really fascinating form of experimenting with how best to use the land. And now, you know, almost 30 years into this experiment of controlling the land and how to make it productive, you see people focusing on this model. There's also, you know, over 10 cooperatives that are operating on the land. They're doing things like dairy, bananas, avocados, you know, cinnamon. So this is a thriving, bustling landscape that compared to industrial agriculture supports way more biodiversity, cools the climate instead of exacerbates climate change like industrial agriculture does, and actually supports the really important complex hydrological cycles of Sumatra, like the watersheds, in a way that industrial agriculture doesn't do as well. So we have this, you know, kind of really remarkable threefold importance of these agroforests to the environment. And then, of course, contributing to a much more equal society where these forests can be quite profitable. They're also quite difficult to establish, take a lot of skill. But once they get going, they don't take much work. You know, they're kind of harnessing ecological cycles. You have to invest time to harvest. But once they're going, you know, they don't need to be tended on a daily basis like many other forms of agriculture. So, yeah, we see like a great promise in this type of agroecology or agroforestry or food forests, they call them there. And, you know, it brings, a lot of hope to seeing how humans and non-humans can live, you know, in much more balance, as people there like to call it, you know, a balance that industrial agriculture and other forms of extractive capitalism don't give us.
You're listening to the Public Policy Channel of the New Books Network, and we have been speaking today with David E. Gilbert, who is the author of Countering Dispossession, Reclaiming Land, a Social Movement Ethnography, from the University of California Press. David, thank you so much for joining us today. Much appreciated.
Cheers.